Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
With a crash there, knocked the phone off. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community's Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. This is your regular co-host, Alan Phillips, and the other regular co-host, Debbie Brock, is not able to be with us today. We're sorry to for that she's not here. We certainly miss her, but we have instead my good friend and partner with the Pandemic Response Project, Rich Roberts, filling in for Debbie. Rich, how are you doing today?
Doing okay. How are you this afternoon, Alan? Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm doing fine, and we are delighted to have you, or I am delighted to have you. I know Debbie is, too. I'll speak for the two of us there. We're going to talk today, as we often do, about some of the recent news items concerning vaccines. In the news lately, there has just been a larger, almost a flood of vaccine-related issues in recent days, so we'll try to touch base on a few of them. We're also going to talk today about exemption rights. You know, we're at the back-to-school time of year, and lots of people are starting to ask, if they have not previously been asking, how do you legally avoid vaccines in schools? And so I'm going to talk about that a little bit today. And we're also coming up on the time of year when hospital employees, as of the last couple of years, and increasingly so, are being told they have to get the flu shot by a certain date, sometime in beginning in either in late summer or on up through fall, depending on the hospital and location of the country and so forth. The policies vary widely around the country. So we'll talk a little bit about how that area works in terms of exemptions, because that's a trickier area. But why don't we dive into a couple of news items first, just to kick things off. Rich, you got any particular article that you'd like to open up with?
Sure. I'm going to kind of start off with the bad article and then proceed to the good article, if that makes sense. But I wanted to first talk about an article that appeared in Forbes called Anti-Vaccine Movement Causes the Worst Whooping Cough Epidemic in 70 Years. And to me, this is just a complete hit piece, but it was worth looking at, you know, just to look at the other side and see the kind of nonsense that they really are throwing at us and using. This is from contributor Stephen Salzberg. And I'll just kind of launch into this. And it's interesting to me as I go through this, Alan, just, you know, I'll point out that so much of the stuff that he says in here, it's more like political rhetoric. There's never any kind of scientific sort of basis or data generally supporting kind of some of the mean things that he says. But sort of moving on, the article kind of starts off saying that the anti-science rhetoric of the anti-vaccine movement is frightening a high number of parents in Washington State to withhold vaccines from their children. And I guess I might point out that the silver lining there is Microsoft, founded by Bill Gates, is headquartered in Seattle, so it's maybe a feather in our cap that that's happening in Microsoft's home state, since Bill Gates, as you know, is one of the leading sponsors of vaccines in the world. But anyway, this report goes on to kind of cite the kind of false herd immunity doctrine, saying that when the vaccine rates drop, everybody becomes more vulnerable to infectious disease. And he specifically criticizes, again, without a whole lot of detail, certain people who have been outspoken somewhat on this issue. Uh, he He criticizes the anti-vaccine misinformation of the, he says, the credulous and anti-science, anti-vax CBS reporter Cheryl Atkinson. So he just kind of takes a hack at her. And
well, you can tell who, you can tell who's making the biggest difference or who's the biggest threat to the pro-vaccine agenda. They're the ones they're going to take down. And Cheryl Atkinson has been vocal about vaccine issues. I first noticed her doing that back during the pandemic, and she was very critical but very particular and detailed in her information and sources. For example, she tried for weeks to get information from the CDC that legally they were obligated to provide her, but they refused to provide it, so she ended up going to states individually and getting the data from states. But the bottom line, she was able to show that the overwhelming majority of swine flu diagnoses were actually incorrect, and the swine flu was far, far less prevalent than originally stated in mainstream news. But go ahead, Rich.
Right. Well, and I do respect her for that. She seems to be one of the few mainstream media people who really will objectively report on this issue and other issues. So I suppose that's why she gets criticized by this article so bad.
It's a badge of honor. A badge of honor to be criticized.
That's right.
By
that's
the
actually a compliment, strangely
yep.
enough. But he also criticizes Dr. Bob Sears, who he says has published his own alternative vaccine schedule in a book filled with anti-vaccine nonsense. He says, of course, he doesn't go on to give us any details about what's so nonsensical about that. He also criticizes the anti-vaccine movement, saying that we continue to claim that vaccines cause autism, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, which I think just the opposite is true as far as I can tell reading, you know, articles and researching this myself.
And, yeah, when you critique or look closely, look beneath the surface of the claims, it's just, I agree with you, exactly the opposite. And when I've written on and talked about vaccine autism connection, I can cite specific studies showing the connection. And I'm not even a medical person who seeks to and have never tried on a medical level to thoroughly explore that. That's just the information that comes to my attention through the social media. And so if I'm seeing information that raises serious questions in terms of published studies, where are these people who are claiming to be medical experts getting their information from? So it's the absence of any support for what they're saying which really identifies the piece as being pure propaganda, just trying to...
Right, and that's why I really just wanted to take a look at this article, just because it's so soft, but this is what we're up against. So I think, you know, we need to sort of train ourselves to start looking at this kind of hit piece and just seeing how soft that it is and just kind of responding, you know, with the truth. I mean, he goes on, and this kind of even gets sort of more nasty. He says that, you know, anti-vaxxers and folks like Dr. Bob use their medical degrees and fake concern for children to frighten parents into keeping their kids unvaccinated. I mean, what an unfounded statement is that? That's really our, as if that's really our our intention here is to frighten people and then have fake, you know, false concerns. But you know, he goes on to just point out that the U.S. is in the midst of the worst whooping cough epidemic in 70 years, and he simply concludes by saying, "For all this, we can thank the anti-vaccination movement." So there's another very general kind of you know, hit where he just basically kind of equates a whooping cough epidemic with the anti-vaccination movement as if,
well, let me,
you know.
Let me take a shot at that, if I may, Rich. I'm gonna do a response here, and I'm going to use, you don't have to get into any of the so-called alternative theories and alternative information to poke large holes in that. I think we've probably seen over time, and I have at least in my own personal research, that with regard to the herd immunity theory, the percentage that they say have to be immune or vaccinated in order for that herd immunity effect to take place. And I'm going to assume, for purposes of my response, that herd immunity is valid. However, it's been disproven over and over again. There are peer-reviewed published studies, many of them over time, and other intelligent attacks on the whole herd immunity theory, and it's really a seriously flawed theory, at least the way that it is put out by the mainstream folks. But we see figures in the range of 90-95%, I think, typically now. They say you need to have at least, you know, 90% coverage to get that herd immunity effect. And then the theory being, of course, then the anti-vaxxers are spreading their propaganda and people are afraid to vaccinate and the numbers go down below 95-90% or whatever, and then you have the outbreaks. Well, first of all, whooping cough or pertussis, it occurs in cycles. Now, I've seen different numbers for the cycles, anywhere from 3 to 5 year cycles, and maybe that varies with location or cycle to cycle, but there is a cyclical nature to pertussis or whooping cough outbreaks. There is not a cyclical nature to vaccination or the exercise of exemptions. So just right off the bat there, there's a lack of any sort of clear correlation. But the thing that's interesting is that the herd immunity theory requires a relatively high percentage. Maybe there's a different number for different diseases, I don't know. But even, let's say, if you said 85%, you know, let's pull the number down. The studies for pertussis show that it has as low an efficacy rate as 70 to 80%. In other words, as many as 20, 25, or even 30% of children who are vaccinated with pertussis, their bodies do not generate the desired immune response that the mainstream view, the vaccination theory, says equates to immunity. And again, just assuming for the moment that antibodies equals immunity, which is a whole other discussion. The point being that if you had 100% vaccine coverage with pertussis, you're not going to reach the level of coverage in terms of effective antibody production to even reach the herd immunity level. You can't get herd immunity with the current pertussis vaccines. And I heard someone talking recently that there was information suggesting that pertussis efficacy rates had been erroneous on the high side, and that maybe as few as I think it was 61% was the figure I heard, are actually getting the proper immune response. It's just not using their own studies, their own figures, mainstream CDC information figures. It's not possible to have a herd immunity effect with the pertussis vaccine.
Right. I mean, it's a complete hit piece. It also doesn't take into account that the whooping cough epidemic, as it's been called, is taking place in fully vaccinated populations. You know, I'm looking at statistics here that state by state, we're looking at in excess of 80% of these cases are occurring in the fully vaccinated. And also, Alan, recently, Washington State Secretary of Health, Mary Selecki, went on record saying that vaccine refusal doesn't appear to be playing any kind of role in the pertussis problem in that state. So a complete hit piece. I mean, also, you know, I just add that it appears like the booster for pertussis is not lasting as long as, you know, is ever billed to. And pertussis appears to just continue to mutate, which makes the vaccine less and less effective. And probably if we get to the science behind that, we'd find that the vaccine is the culprit in creating the mutation in the first place.
There have been some articles recently talking about that very point, that we may unwittingly be contributing to or facilitating mutation, and we're finding that a lot of what they're finding when they test is not the same thing that the vaccine supposedly protects from. Dr. Mayer Eisenstein was mentioning a couple of interesting points here, that there's something called parapertussis, sort of a closely related but different germ, and that's what some of these pertussis cases are turning out to actually be. It's not even the same disease that's being vaccinated against. So even if the vaccine works, or when it works, it's not going to help you if it's not the same disease. But Dr. Eisenstein also mentioned something else real interesting recently. He said the test that they use for pertussis has as much as a 30 or 40% false positive rate. Now, I don't know how many of the pertussis outbreaks that are being diagnosed around the country are being diagnosed based on symptoms or are they doing tests. But to the extent that they're testing, again, according to Dr. Eisenstein, it's not a particularly reliable test. And so there's a plus or minus, broad plus or minus error margin here for all this. But I don't doubt for a moment that there are pertussis outbreaks going on around the country. What I do question and have great concern about is the exact point that you raised, Rich, that this is being used as an opportunity to promote the pro-vaccine agenda. But we've got a real interesting situation here, because I think this kind of propaganda is being seen more and more for exactly what it is, people just throwing out general ideas and concepts and things, not backing their point of view. The people that take a little extra time to look at the information, to make any kind of even relatively superficial critical assessment or critical analysis, we'll find that it's not as none of these kind of sweeping statements on one side or the other, for that matter, really hold weight. You really have to go a little deeper than that. You do have to look at other factors like the things we've discussed today to have a better picture of what's going on. And I think this strategy, this all-or-nothing strategy, is going to be the downfall of the current pharmaceutical establishment. They had and may still have the opportunity to meet somewhere in the middle where they can save a little credibility and acknowledge some credibility to an opposing agenda or opposing viewpoint being ourselves. But I think their failure to do that, while they may get some mileage in the short run with these kind of sweeping fear tactics, it's going to ultimately be their downfall, because people are going to see it for what it is and are increasingly doing exactly that. I think it's going to come back to bite them in the butt.
Well, it feels good just to expose at least one hit piece and just point out the inadequacy of the detail. But I want to move along. As always, we can talk a long time on any one report, and I know you want to get on to some exemption stuff. So let's take a look at a second report here. And this is from the Bolin Report, Tim Bolin.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about this very important court case that's going on right now, Alan, concerning autism. And this is Hooker versus the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And basically, what's interesting about this case is that Brian Hooker had sued the CDC to get copies of internal memorandums, emails, letters, etc., that would demonstrate that they knew that there was a connection between autism and vaccinations. And Brian Hooker is a biochemist and PhD, so he's not just, you know, this is a very scientific person. And after looking at the evidence that thimerosal was safe and effective as a preservative in vaccines, he basically just didn't feel that the proof was anywhere near scientifically adequate. And so he began to question and asked for information from the CDC, and basically he was stonewalled for 6 years. But what Brian Hooker did, which is really quite clever, he set up a trap for the CDC because he was in possession of some of the documents that he was requesting, and he knew where more of them were. And so basically what he did was he demanded the documents, and he let the CDC reply that, you know, they didn't have the documents or that the documents were not pertinent or relevant. And then he kind of presented the documents and, you know, exposed them as lying. So this could potentially set this up for a criminal indictment. So it's a kind of interesting strategy. So things are heating up, and the federal judge has went on to actually order the CDC to produce these documents. So the judge isn't buying the CDC's arguments about withholding information in this case. So, you know, hopefully, you know, this search for documents and the way this case is going down is uncovering a pattern of criminal activity on the part of the CDC.
Well, this is really fascinating stuff, Rich. when you have a civil lawsuit, and I imagine I don't do criminal practice, I imagine there's a same or similar process in the criminal procedure as well, but in civil procedure, there is what they call the discovery process, where you can request any information or documents or and do other things to get information from the other side. Of course, both sides can do that with one another, but the purpose of this is to create, as much as possible, fairness in the legal system. There are always going to be exceptions, though, where somebody has something and they can say, well, we have it, but we can't produce it or don't have to produce it because of this or that or the other. So like everything in law, there are exceptions. But this is fascinating. One of the things, though, is that you don't have to not have what you're asking for in order to ask for it. In other words, you can have what you're asking for. You can do exactly what you just described. He has some of the documents that he was asking for and didn't reveal that information and didn't have to, and then asked for documents, including ones he already had. So it was a beautiful trap. I love it. It's going to be real interesting to see how this plays out. I think people in the CDC are probably getting real nervous and scrambling now, because for so long these folks have been able to do whatever they want to serve the pharmaceutical industry and get away with it. And I'm not convinced that all the courts are always outside of the politics either, but hopefully this court will be, and things will go forward in a way that truth and justice would require. So we'll have to keep tabs on this issue and see how it plays out.
Right. I'm hopeful that we're starting to see an avalanche of legal activity that is going to expose this more and more. Tim Boling goes on to conclude this report, and I do agree with him by saying that the people who are involved in denying that thimerosal and vaccines, you know, is dangerous, are some of the worst criminals in the history of mankind. And he even says that, you know, this overshadows any genocide effort in the history of the planet. If you really look at the numbers of children damaged and the cost to society worldwide that we're seeing from this. So he really kind of finishes with a heavy hand in terms of pointing out just really how bad that this is. And I think that's important to do that, since there's so much fluff on the other side. So a very interesting case, very interesting article here.
Yeah, to go from a position where, in terms of the knowledge view perspective of the general public, which is more or less that vaccines are mostly okay, to words like genocide is a huge, huge, huge leap, I think, for most people. And yet, when you look at the international scope of what's going on, what they've known about, what they've covered up, and we have this now. I mean, we have some of the documents showing that the CDC and study authors, with what's called the Denmark study, I think it was a 2003 study, that they had the data showing that when they took the mercury out of vaccines, autism rates went down. Very
right.
Strong evidence of a causal relationship. There have been other studies showing a causal or suggesting causal relationship with vaccines as well, and you put several suggestions together, you know, it makes the likelihood of the connection in a scientific manner increasingly greater each time you have another study that shows some kind of correlation. So we'll have to watch this over time. It'll be real interesting. Well, let me step aside for just a couple of minutes from the news, and we'll come back to some more because there's just tons of stuff here. But I wanted to give just a little introduction and overview about school exemptions, because it's that time of year again. The school, first of all, just very briefly, Rich, the category or topic of exemptions and waivers in the broad sense covers many, many different areas. We all think of school exemptions when you talk about vaccine exemptions, but there's also exemption issues with employees, in particular healthcare employees. There's issues with people in the military, members and military members and their families. There's issues with immigration. Immigrants are required to be vaccinated, the legal ones anyway.
somebody, good point.
Well, no, it was really funny. I had never even thought about that. I'd been working with immigrant clients for some time, and I had occasion to be talking with an immigration attorney, which I'm not, And he made reference to the fact, you know, and there's what, an estimated something on the order of 12 million illegal immigrants in the U.S., and probably none of them are vaccinated, but if you're going to do it legally, you have to file an application that just the application fee with the Immigration Service is almost $600, and then if you're going to really give yourself the best chance, because that particular area is a complicated one to pull off, you really should hire an attorney knowledgeable in that area.
That brings up an interesting point, Alan, with the illegal immigrants. Even if they tried to get vaccinated, I wonder if that would expose them, if they really can't get vaccinated even if they wanted to.
Well, somebody was pointing out when they were talking several months ago in California about a pertussis outbreak, and they were claiming that it had 10 deaths of babies, and somebody was pointing out, well, let's look at the immigration status. If an illegal immigrant has a health problem, they're going to be slower to go to a doctor to get help because they don't want to be exposed. And maybe some of these infants were children of illegal immigrants, and so they waited too long to go to a doctor or a hospital, and maybe the child could have been saved had they gone. I'm not you saying that as a comment one way or another about the immigration issue. It's just if that has ever occurred, it's just so unfortunate.
Right.
But easy to understand how it could occur. And some people suggested that at least some of the infant pertussis deaths in California were that kind of situation.
Right.
But anyway, exemptions, the question of how do you legally avoid vaccines comes up in a number of different categories and subcategories. And the school category now, I'm going to break that down because this one has several different subcategories and questions. And it, I define for my own purposes in terms of my exemption and waiver practice, I define a category or subcategory as any time there's different law that applies. So the school exemptions... every state and U.S. territory has its own separate laws, and so the vaccine requirements and exemptions allowed and the procedure for exercising exemptions is going to vary from state to state, territory to territory. But there are also some federal contexts. If you are in the military and your kids are on a military base, you're on federal property, you're subject to federal law. The state law might be an influencing factor, but you'd be looking to exercise an exemption under the Federal Department of Defense regulations and not under the state law. So there are some federal law areas, even with school exemptions. But I sometimes see we have sort of different categories. You have the preschool or daycare arena, you have then grade school, and then you have college or post-secondary schools, and sometimes they have different exemption laws for these different areas. We have public schools and private schools. Whether or not the exemption applies to private schools is a question that varies from state to state depending on the specific wording of individual state laws. Most states – did you have a comment there, a question, Rich?
Well, I'm just always glad to hear you talk about this subject, Alan, and all the intricacies of it, because I get so tired of just talking to people and they have this knee-jerk reaction that you have to get vaccinations if you want to go to public school, essentially. And there seems to be, you know, a concerted effort to make people think that and not really realize that they do have exemption rights. But also, you know, when you talk about it, it becomes apparent very quickly, you know, how fixed that this subject is. And depending on the state or the situation, it gets really complex. And so I think it helps people realize that in many cases, you know, they really do need to consult an attorney to make sure that they have their ducks in a row if they want to claim these exemptions.
Well, let me give a couple comments because you raised a couple of good points there. It turns out that, I mean, and I haven't searched all 50 states' laws by any means on this specific point I'm about to mention here, but I think it's probably very much the exception that there's law that requires the state to notify you of the exemption. The reason for that or the rationale for it would be that public policy favors vaccination. And so they're not going to put a law that requires you to inform anybody of the exemption. And they don't want people exercising exemptions because they think that's contrary to good health policy, and in the mainstream view of vaccines, that would be the case, and that's currently what drives most of the laws in most states at this point. We need to work, of course, to change that. But there actually are, I have actually seen laws in a couple of states that do require the state to notify you of the exemption. Now, anecdotal reports suggest that that's not happening, but the laws, but the laws are there. And on at least a common sense level, well, there are a lot of laws in the vaccine arena that are on the books but don't happen. For example, there's federal law that requires doctors to report any suspected vaccine injury to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And yet the National Vaccine Information Center conducted surveys a few years ago, and there was no state that had as many as 50% of doctors responding to surveys saying that they do report suspected adverse events, but New York was the lowest, and New York had only 2.5% of pediatricians of 40 that were surveyed saying that they would that they do report vaccine adverse events. So you're required to report under federal law, but there's no enforcement mechanism. There's no penalty, and so they don't do it.
That's such an important fact, Alan, because what it shows us is, you know, even though we know about so much adverse reaction to vaccines, what we know about is just the tip of the iceberg because it's not been reported. And so we have a much larger problem even than we think, and we already know we have a huge problem. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and CDC and others have said that as many as 90 to 99% of vaccine adverse events aren't reported. And so anybody who tells you there's a net benefit to vaccines is either lying or doesn't know what they're talking about, because there just is no data out there to make the assessment. And the absence of data and the absence of the ability to make an assessment in and of itself is justification for anybody in any situation to be able to say no thanks to a vaccine without having to justify it at all. But for the largest number of people, the available exemption is a religious exemption. And again, the procedure varies from state to state. If my general rule of thumb for when do you need an attorney or when should you consider consulting an attorney with an exemption is only in those situations where you need to state what your religious beliefs are and the local authorities have the authority to scrutinize the exemption. And many states, you check a box, you sign a form, you write a simple statement saying it's against my religious beliefs. You don't have to get into explaining what your beliefs are. You don't need an attorney in any of those situations. Now, it might still be prudent to get information about the law so you understand more about the rights. But in terms of the procedure, many people don't need an attorney. But those situations where you have to state your beliefs and the authorities have the ability to scrutinize it, the beliefs, if it's really important, it's important to do it right and get it right. Because this is not one of those situations, Rich, where you can afford to get rejected and then come back and try to say, oops, what I really meant to say was, I mean,
right.
You know, once you've had some fundamental flaw, it's really hard to correct that retrospectively.
So you have to get it right the first time when you're working with vaccine exemptions, or else you could lose that right permanently.
Well, you know, it's going to vary case to case, but yes, generally you're much, much better off if you get it right the first time. Attorneys make a lot of money trying to bail people out of things that they could have avoided altogether if they'd only gone to an attorney and done a consultation up front. It's a real big part of legal practice. And I'm not saying that being critical of non-attorneys, because law is inherently complex. Our legal system is immensely complex. Attorneys practice for years trying to figure it out, and most of them will focus on one or a very few areas, and it's all you can do to keep up with whatever your focus area is, let alone the law generally. But so people don't often recognize that they need or would be better off or should consider hiring an attorney up front. So this is why I try to clarify when I think people should be asking themselves that question. But my ebook, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccine Legal Exemptions, and that's available at vaccinerights.com, that the ebook goes into great depth and detail about providing information on exemptions and waivers. It's the only publication I know anywhere that has reliable and authoritative information and that goes in depth to the extent that my ebook does. And the whole point of the ebook was to provide the information that people need to be able to make an informed decision or informed decisions about exemptions, including when do you need an attorney, because, again, many times you don't.
Well, one of my major frustrations with the exemption process, Alan, is that we don't have very many existing philosophical exemptions. Basically, what we're left with is a religious exemption, and I think that frames the whole debate in a way that works against us. I mean, consider a person who's not, you know, religious. You know, they probably don't feel comfortable taking a religious exemption. It just doesn't sort of fit with them, but yet they won't let you argue the science with them. And so I'm grateful to have the religious exemption, while at the same time I feel as if it's a very good strategic move by the pro-vaccine folks to kind of put the debate in those terms.
Well, let me explain at least one, give you a I guess you could call it a legal argument as to why you shouldn't try to explain. And this is a mistake that a lot of people, when they're writing their own statements of religious belief, they fall into. In effect, in one manner or degree or another, they want to argue that, that they want to bring the vaccine controversy into their religious belief statement. And that's a huge, there's probably a better way to say this, but that's a huge no-no in the legal arena of things. Vaccines, in order to be administered in the U.S., they have to be licensed by the FDA. And they're, in being licensed, in getting through this presumably rigorous licensing procedure, when they come out the other end, they are legally presumed to be reasonably safe and effective. Now, you and I might disagree with that. I certainly do. But as a legal matter, I mean, if the FDA worked the way it was supposed to work, this would be probably valid factually as well as legally. But right now, regardless of the truth factually, legally, vaccines are legally safe and effective, reasonably safe and effective, just for being licensed. The same thing happens when a state legislature or federal agency, such as the military and immigration, mandates vaccines for whatever purpose or population, kids getting in school in terms of states. The state legislature is presumed to have considered whether or not vaccines are reasonably safe and effective, and the enactment of the vaccine mandate, therefore, carries with it a legal presumption that the vaccines are, in fact, reasonably safe and effective. Here's my point, Rich. It's not that if we disagree, there's nothing we can do about it. It's that if we disagree, the place not to take that issue is in your statement of religious beliefs, because for legal purposes it's a moot point, and probably it's not going to qualify as a religious belief anyway if you're arguing science.
Right.
Where we have to take the argument is the state legislature. We need to go back to them and say, hey, here's the information you missed or didn't consider or dismissed previously or whatever, and change the laws and so forth. So it's about where you take the argument, and your statement of religious beliefs is not the place to do that.
Right. So the practical reality for people who want to, you know, file an exemption is that they just need to stick to, you know, the religious exemption and not try to argue, you know, any more of these details. Not in that context.
Yeah, exactly. If you're exercising a religious exemption and you're in one of those situations where you have to state your beliefs. So with school exemptions, let me go one more quick point with that, and let's try to get us back into some more news things, because there's so much going on. The starting place is your state's statute or statutes and regulations. In most states, you have to, from what I've seen so far anyway, you have to look at a combination of the state statute, exemption statute or statutes, but also health department regulations. And many times it's in the regulations where you find that the state has a form, the health department creates a form, or that they have some other particular about the procedure or what does and doesn't qualify. So sometimes it's a combination. I know here in North Carolina, where you and I are, Rich, we have an amazingly simple process. We have only one statute for the religious exemption, and it's a two-sentence statute, and then there's no regulations that add any more information or procedure or detail or process or whatever. In some states, you'll have a health department create a form, But you've also got a procedure in the state statute, and then arguably at least you may even have two different ways to exercise the exemption. Other times the state legislature in the statutes will delegate authority to the health department, so you have some preliminary information about it in the statutes, but the details and the procedure are in the regulations. This, like everything else we keep talking about, varies from state to state. There is no generic national generic exemption form or affidavit or letter or statement of beliefs or whatever. And so as much as I truly and genuinely admire and appreciate anti-vaccine websites because they have a wealth of information about why you might want to avoid vaccines, they often have a mixture of accurate and inaccurate information when it gets into the details of how you exercise the exemption. So I do urge caution when you're going out on the internet looking for how to exercise an exemption. The starting place is the authority, and the authority in this instance is the state legislature and state health departments, and they will have the statutes and regulations to tell you how to do this. Now, they can't provide all the information, but that's your starting place. If you have to write a statement of religious beliefs, the question that immediately applies to that then is, well, what does and doesn't qualify? And that's a much more complex question. That's actually a federal law question, because even with state exemption laws, it's the First Amendment's free exercise clause, which refers to the free exercise of religion. Our constitutional First Amendment is what governs what does and doesn't qualify for a vaccine religious exemption in terms of the beliefs, because the federal law is a higher legal authority, and on this particular point and some others, the federal constitution also applies to state and local governments. Parts of the federal constitution apply also to state and local governments in addition to the federal government, and those parts that apply include the First Amendment free exercise of religion. So that's a whole more complicated question we won't get into right now, but we look at legal precedent to tell us where the boundaries are. How does the First Amendment, what does and doesn't qualify for that First Amendment protection, and therefore for a state or federal religious exemption?
Well, hopefully this discussion just helps to make people more aware of the fact that they do have exemption rights and that they don't just necessarily have to buy into vaccinations if they want to send their kids to public school. And hopefully the discussion also helps people realize that depending on the situation, exemption rights can be tricky business, and so they need to research this and, if appropriate, get an attorney so that they can exercise these exemptions.
That's right. Well, Rich, you got anything else on the news front that caught your attention this week?
I do have another article here that I want to talk about, and this was very good news, and so I like to talk about the good news. But this is from the PR Newswire, and this article is discussing how the World Health Organization has failed in its effort to defend mercury in vaccines before the United Nations. So basically the history on this was that WHO was bowing to pressure from the Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs, or COMED, as it's called. Apparently, they have quite a bit of they're starting to have quite a bit of political power to sort of be influencing WHO. But WHO was revealing its 2004 guidelines on reducing thimerosal vaccines before the UN. They were actually disclosing before the United Nations Environmental Program, or UNEP, and basically, the WHO was getting unprecedented resistance to its defense of the use of mercury in vaccines, which is a fairly huge development, because generally it just seems like we just skim right over this. But it's not just COMED. This article points out that other organizations and governments are beginning to strongly oppose the use of mercury and thimerosal in vaccines and other medicines, and that we have entire countries and even continents expressing their desire for mercury-free vaccinations. And COMED works with some of these nations in trying to ban thimerosal-preserved vaccines. Recently, Chile became the first developing country, for instance, to ban the use of mercury in this year, 2012. So it's interesting. We're seeing this resistance this article goes on to point out, actually this is a quote from Reverend Lisa K. Sykes, who's president of COMED, that they also have the support of the United Methodist Church in terms of, you know, supporting them and opposing mercury and vaccines. So you're talking about 11.5 million people in the United Methodist Church, Alan. And also they have the U.S. National Health Freedom Coalition, so that's 20 million more. So we're seeing like huge kind of conglomerates of people, even nations, grouping together to support a ban on mercury and vaccines and also to uphold the right of informed consent for persons. So I think this is very good news, and this is happening on an international stage. I guess my one concern about this, Alan, is that while it does seem that mercury is one of the main culprits in terms of causing adverse reactions, it seems like we set the stage for a scenario where if the vaccine manufacturers remove mercury, they could sort of claim that, you know, they've sort of given in to all of our demands, when there are also a lot of other nasty things in vaccines. So this is not the whole debate, but it's definitely a step in the right direction and good news if we could get this accomplished.
Well, I think it's a really good point, Rich. Just last fall, there was a peer-reviewed published study that said that the aluminum in vaccines may have a causal relationship to autism. Again, not saying that it did, but in effect saying here's something that needs to be looked at more closely, you know, studied to see what we can see here. As you know, Rich, there's a long list of toxic ingredients in vaccines, including formaldehyde and antifreeze.
Other things that it sounds so stupid on the surface.
It does, but you know, the theory being that they're in such small quantities that the body can handle them just fine, and you know, the empirical evidence at least suggests that for many people that's just not the case. And some people go so far as to say there's damage with any vaccine administered to anyone at any time. It's just a question of the degree and style for each individual person. And for some people, there seems to be a cumulative effect that they have reactions that increase in severity with subsequent vaccines. But other time, I heard a story, had someone contact me and tell me, their personal story, about a 16-year-old who was perfectly fine and got a vaccine and then developed autism after that. And that
right.
seemed to me, I've only heard of that once, so hoping that that's an isolated case, but, you know, because we think so much of autism as something that you have a normal, healthy child and then they start regressing for some reason, and by the way, it just happened to happen shortly after they got a certain vaccine. And is there a relationship? And last year we had a published review from a former senior pharmaceutical research scientist, Helen Ratajczak, and her conclusion included, she did a review of the autism literature from the 1940s to the present, and her conclusion included, among other things, that she believes that that autism is a consequence or does follow from encephalitis following immunization, encephalitis, the inflammation of the brain following immunization. So she basically said that vaccines are a cause of autism. She didn't say the cause, she said a cause. But that's still a serious concern, serious consideration.
Right. Right. Well, it's definitely good news that people are kind of banding together and starting to speak out against this at like an international level. So, are you still there, Alan?
I am.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, please go ahead. I thought I heard you cut off there for a moment.
You know, I had a bleep on the phone here, so new phone system here, so I'm not quite fully up to speed on it. But yeah, I mean, lots of stuff going on there. You know, I want to mention just real briefly here. I don't want to go into detail on it, but because there's so many things here, we could just read some titles of articles just to give people an idea of what's going on. But here's one that talks about the Pentagon preparing millions of vaccines against future global flu. And I know when someone had sent the email or made the Facebook post talking about this article, it was like, what is the military doing producing vaccines. What's going on here?
I had that same thought when I saw that article, Alan. It's just freaky. The Pentagon, what is the Pentagon doing, you know, in healthcare? It makes no sense. It's almost like the militarization of healthcare.
Well, we've had a certain amount of militarization of healthcare already going on, I think, but this is from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they say that they've produced 10 million doses of an influenza vaccine in only 1 month's time, and that's scary for a lot of reasons, because I'm nervous about routine vaccines. I'm more nervous about fast-track emergency vaccines because they make them more quickly. It takes a few months, but they make them more quickly than routine immunizations. Because of the quote-unquote emergency status, they will hold off on some of the research and testing that they do with the routine immunizations. And if you've produced something in a month, who knows what that means. You know, Rich, I've just noticed that we have a caller, and I'm going to put the caller in.
Okay.
Debbie, is that you?
Yes, it is. I'm just listening to the end of your show. It sounds quite interesting. I don't know all what you've covered today, but I do have concern about fast-track vaccines and the fact that they might have ingredients that have not been tested.
Well, I mean, if you're going to produce something in a month, you know, where is there room for testing? You know, when the usual fast-track procedure takes... I've heard 6 months. I don't know what a production process for routine immunizations might typically involve time-wise, but presumably longer than that. So, I mean, on the one hand, you know, maybe this is just some amazing breakthrough in vaccine production, and now we can make, you know, emergency vaccines quickly and nip a serious epidemic or pandemic in the bud. But having seen the history of vaccines as I know of it today, I'm not about to jump to that conclusion without some serious additional information to support it.
We already know the long-term effects of vaccines, so not knowing from 1 month to 6 months to a number of years or decades down the line, I don't see how they could call them safe.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with this. You know, is the military getting into the vaccine production business here? I'm just not really sure what this is about. But I'll just mention, I know, Rich, I think, I don't know if you pulled the articles you talked about earlier today from the Pandemic Response Project website or not, but often the news items that we talk about here on the Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. show are articles that have links posted to them on the Pandemic Response Project website. That's pandemicresponseproject.com, pandemicresponseproject.com, all spelled out, and then there's a news link at the top right of every page on that site. So encourage folks listening to check that out. Just tons of information, and there is just stuff happening on a regular basis in this arena. We can't possibly cover it all on the air, so go see the news page on the website.
Do you think that there's a conflict of interest to have the military in the medical field? It sounds more like bio warfare.
Right.
Well, there certainly is a crossover in military and pharmaceutical interests, specifically bioterrorism. But it's interesting. I mean, is the Pentagon trying to compete with the pharmaceutical industry? I'm not clear what's going on here, and the article might give a little insight to that. But it's an interesting question. And what do you see, Debbie, as a potential conflict of interest?
Well, it seems like those people who are strictly for caring for the individual's health should be in charge of examining and manufacturing these products, whereas the military has a different function. I know it's security, but it seems as if more and more power going into the military is... When I think of something that is in a state of balance, even in the law, the checks and balances in the sections of government, when one section has too much power, then we have an out of balance system, and this can lead to dysfunction or control where we don't want it.
And an abuse of power. We've seen, I mean, I think over a period of decades, if perhaps not, maybe even throughout the history of our country, but certainly in recent years and decades, increasing centralization of power, particularly at the federal level. And yet, I think the founders contemplated just the opposite, a very small federal government. The more power is centralized, it's a really simple concept, and we see this happening in fact as well, not just at the concept level, but that the more centralized power is, the more potential there is for that power to be misused or abused to the benefit of someone it's not intended to benefit, and along with that, to the potential detriment of people it's supposed to be serving. And so we hear people in the alternative arena talk about all the time about how the people in the CDC and the FDA are serving the pharmaceutical industry and not the public that it's supposedly.
So where is the checks and balances in this state of affairs?
Well, I think there are not enough checks and balances. I think there's too much. I mean, I don't think there are broad conspiracies. I think most people who are medical doctors, most people who work for the pharmaceutical industry and work for state and federal agencies are decent people of integrity, but it only takes a few key decision makers to be controlling all of the rest. And I hear, for example, from nurses all the time and other hospital employees, you know, I don't want to get the vaccine. We now have to get the vaccine or we get fired. But I'm not going to say anything because they'll single me out and fire me if I try to get an exemption. Or I hear from the ones who come to me asking me for help, they say they have peers. You know, there's five other people in my department who don't want the vaccine, but they're afraid to say anything. You know, it doesn't take a unanimous or even majority group for there to be a group position. You know, their polls during the pandemic showed that a majority of healthcare workers didn't want the flu vaccine, and yet now hospitals are aiming for and achieving 90-95% or higher flu vaccination rate, not because they all changed their mind and said, yes, now I want the vaccine, because they were all told, get the vaccine or you're fired, and they can't afford individually, most of them can't afford to lose their job, and so they just have to chance it. But it's not because of any sort of agreement and wish on the part of many of them. We're getting near the end of the showtime here. Rich and Debbie both, I'd like to give, you know, each of you a chance to add any other comment here, and then we'll close down and we'll be back next week. You're listening
well,
to...
Well, I really, Alan, I appreciate you covering the show today and taking care of everything. I will be back in the usual schedule next Thursday. We will have Monday the Health In Show, and I think Joette Calabrese is going to be talking about creating awareness for mothers and homeopathy. And then on Wednesday, Dr. Adil Hasim is going to be back answering your questions about anything in your health. I mean, he's a cardiologist, but he can answer any question for you. And then we have your show. So I'm really thankful to have you.
Well, thanks for calling.
I have to hang up, too.
All right. Well, thanks for checking in today, Debbie. It's great to have you. Debbie is our regular co-host with this Thursday show, and we'll be delighted to have you back.
Don't forget to check out all of the vaccination articles on Homeopathy World Community. There's many of them there. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take
care. Debbie. Well, Alan, I would just like to add that, you know, I'm glad that we had this talk about this broader conversation about conflict of interest, because it's quite obvious that there are economic conflicts of interest. But when you really think about it, I mean, that's sort of the obvious thing. That's about the best thing we could say, is that, you know, there are economic conflicts of interest. But it doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine that there could be more dark occult conflicts of interest and agendas going on here. And it seems like we've entered into a situation now where we have an annual, you know, pandemic kind of fears, and the media kind of supports it and spreads it around, and it just seems like it just seems like we're entering into a situation where it's all too easy for the powers that be to just declare that it's an emergency and demand that everybody on the planet roll up their sleeve to take a shot, and it's just way too much power, it just seems like we would be foolish to kind of do that trustingly, given what we know about the pharmaceutical industry and some of the, you know, inappropriate connections with government and military.
Well, at the risk of sounding naive, Rich, I'm going to take a cue from David Wilcock and say the powers that were. It's also from other ideas that, you know, we focus on, we attract or create more of what we focus on. There's a metaphysical principle that says something to that effect, if not that. And so it's important for us to acknowledge the problem, but let's also focus on what we want. So I'm going to say the powers that were.
The powers that were. Okay, I can go with that.
The powers that were, even though they presently are, but let's look ahead to what we want. Because, again, I think these folks are setting themselves up for a fall. I think they're ultimately going to find that the shift happening underneath them is broader and bigger and more powerful than they're giving it credit for. We will see. Rich, thank
right.
you so much for coming on today and filling in. Always glad to have you here. Your comments and insights are terrific, and I hope you'll come back with us again soon.
Certainly, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Goodbye, all. We'll see you next Thursday, same time.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Share your light, let your truth